Okay. When we finished up Sunday, Eric didn't quite get all of his finished up, and I told him that I could finish it up in just a few minutes. So, maybe. Okay. There we go. All right. Okay. If you remember, we talked about the central campaign. That's what Eric was working on. And the central campaign consisted of Jericho, Ai, and Bethel. Basically, those three are consisted in that. Also, remember that they went up to Shechem, and they were on Mount Ebal, Mount Gerizim, and they were talking back and forth. They were giving the blessings and the curses from one and the blessings from the other. Then they came back down to the area, the central campaign area. And we'll talk about that in just a few minutes. I was able to pick this up off of the internet. It's Mount Gerizim on the left right here. It's Mount Ebal over there. This is Shechem in the middle. Kind of gives you a general idea of where they were. I don't know how low on the hillside they were when they read the dole of the curses and the blessings. But you can see it's a pretty good distance across. And it may be just a natural arena type thing where the sound would travel across. I don't know. But anyway, that's what I was able to find of those two mountains, Palestine. Okay, the southern campaign begins chapter 9, verses 1 through 10:43. And chapter 9 begins with the defeat of Jericho, as we learned earlier. Then Ai and Bethel, and then the Israelites move up to Shechem and back down to Mount Ebal, Mount Gerizim. And then the southern campaign begins with the kings on the west side of Jordan hearing about the Gibeonites, how they had gone to the Israelites and made a treaty with them. And the Gibeonites came to the camp of Israel, if you remember, and they tricked the Israelites. And with the deception, in chapter 9, verse 1 through 27, it gives that deception. Israel was to make no covenant with the people of the land, if you remember, from Exodus 23:32 and 34:12, Deuteronomy 7, verse 2. But the Gibeonites figured out that Israel was not making covenants with the people, and so they devised a plan that they came from a far country and dressed accordingly. Said, "We have heard of the reputation of Jehovah your God, and we've heard that the things done in Egypt and to Sihon and Og." They did not say anything about Jericho or Ai or Bethel, if you notice. Well, if they had have said that, then they would have automatically known they were from that area. But they told them they were from a distant place. And they went on to say that our elders told us to take supplies for the journey and to come and make a treaty with you. We left, the bread was hot, and of course, when they got there, it was dry and moldy. And the wineskins were filled with when they were new, but now they're old and they're cracked and don't hold any water or anything. That's what they drank out of. Clothes and the shoes had become worn from their long journey. And the problem was the Israelites were convinced that they were truthful in what they said. They did not seek the help from Jehovah. First mistake. Should have done. They should have checked with Jehovah. Thought that they. But anyway, they went on and made the treaty. 3 days later, they found out that they were indeed the Gibeonites who lived very nearby. Joshua called them in and asked, "Why have you done this?" And they said, "Well, we've heard how you destroy everyone you come in contact with. And so now we're in your hands. You've made a treaty with us. We're in your hands. Whatever you decide to do with us, that we'll accept it. Now, that'll be fine." So they were made to be water carriers and woodcutters and carriers, all that was necessary for the temple or for the tabernacle. To think about it, that could be a pretty good task. All of the sacrifices that were made, they had to bring all the wood and they had to bring the water to wash all the priest's hands and all the parts of the sacrifice that had to be washed and so forth. So anyway, we learn in 1 Chronicles 9:22 that the Gibeonites came to have a semi-official capacity along with the priests and the Levites. That was because of their work as far as bringing the wood and the water and so forth. Okay, so the southern campaign begins with the Gibeonites in working in the dealing with them, and this is actually where we'll actually begin the lesson for tonight. Just a real quick summary of what Eric didn't finish up Sunday, and I knew I wouldn't have time to do a whole lot, but that's a pretty familiar story about the Gibeonites. Anyway, Adonizedek, king of Jerusalem, heard that the Gibeon had made peace with Israel. We find that in chapter 10, verse 1, how he was concerned about it, so he became afraid, knowing Gibeon was a great city, and the things that might take place as time went by. And so he sends messengers to the following kings: Hoham, king of Hebron; Piram, king of Jarmuth; Japhia, king of Lachish; and Deber, king of Eglon. He sent a message to them, letting them know what Gibeon had done. And just to give you an idea about these places, Hebron is here, Jarmuth is right here, Lachish, Deber, and that's all of those that where he had actually sent letters to or messengers to let them know what was about to take place. So the message stated for all of them to come and join forces and to go against Gibeon. You'd think, why not go against Israel? But that wasn't what they wanted to do. They wanted to go against Gibeon and to get them to come back and join their ranks, their forces, against Israel, because they knew they were a big city, more or less. And Gibeon instead called for their new allies to come and help them, according to verse 6, chapter 10. And just to briefly look at that, the men of Gibeon sent unto Joshua to the camp of Gilgal, saying, "Slack not thy hand from thy servants. Come up to us quickly and save us. Help us, for all the kings of the Amorites that dwell in the mountains are gathered together against us." Verse 6, chapter 10. And so they were concerned about what was going to happen at that particular if they all got together and came against them. So Gibeon messaged Joshua, "Don't delay, but you come in a hurry to rescue us." And they further explained how all the kings had joined forces. Joshua gathered his army together, and God told him to do not be afraid of them, because I will deliver them into your hands. Not a man of them will stand before you, according to verse 8. Lord said unto Joshua, "Fear them not, for I have delivered them into thine hand. There shall not a man of them stand before thee." Joshua and all Israel traveled all night and made a surprise attack on the Amorites. They could not fight because of Jehovah, and the battle turned out to be, you might say, a rout. And they fled to Beth Horon, which descends very steeply, going west, hills. Jehovah cast down great stones upon them. This could have been hailstones from heaven, a rock slide of some kind. I don't know. We don't know for sure, but it possibly was hailstones that was actually falling upon them. And more died by the hand of Jehovah than by the Israelites' hand in battle. Israel pursued armies to Azekah. Most of the battle took place in the Shephelah, or the rolling hills. Where's the Shephelah? Who can tell me where the Shephelah is? That's all right. Go ahead. Tell me, Charles. Right. It's between that and coastal plains. Okay. Very good. That's good. Thank you. Between the hill country and the coastal plains is the Shephelah. And that's where most of the battle took place. They pursued them, and Joshua prayed to God, and he asked something. What was it? What did he ask God? Well, let the sun go down. Why would it be important for the sun not to go down? Yeah, when it gets dark, you know, people can hide. And these people who were fleeing, they could hide, you know, in caves or, you know, behind rocks or whatever they could find, and behind trees maybe. And so the armies would not be able to see them. So it was very important that the sun did not go down. And Joshua, the 10th chapter, verse 12 and 13, read that for us, Jimmy. A whole day extra that they had to battle. That's just unfathomable in our little minds. How the sun could do that, just stand still for a whole day. But that's what happened. And that let the armies of Israel get all of these people, capture them, and destroy them. That's kind of a artist in fiction of the sun standing still. I don't know. I'm fond of that. But anyway, but that this all happened in and around Gibeon there. The day of the sun stood still, the Amorites were fleeing from Israel, and they could hardly wait for the darkness to hide them, and imagine their thoughts as they fled from the Israelite army, and the sun didn't go down. You know, man, I'll be glad when dark gets here. And they just keep saying, I'll be glad when dark gets here. And it didn't come, you know, until they were basically all, a lot of them are defeated or killed. We're told that there has been none like this day before this, none after this. Never a day before like this, or none, never a day like this after it. And though, that's in chapter 10, verse 14. The five kings fled before Israel. Kings all went into a cave at Makeda to hide, and it was located near Lachish in Eglon. Joshua was told where they were hiding, so he ordered the stones to be put over the entrance to close them in. Everyone else continued to chase the enemy because Jehovah has given them into our hands. That's what Joshua told the rest of the army. Y'all keep going. Leave a few guards here and the rest of you go on. They had the stones over the cave. So they kept them there for a time until they could get back to them to deal with them after the battle. This is Makeda. This is where the cave was right here, where all the five kings went to. The fighting, a lot of it was over for now, and those who were left had fled into some fortified cities. Joshua and his army returned to the cave where the kings had been trapped, and he ordered the cave to be opened up, and they took the stones out, took the kings out, and he ordered them to lie down on the ground. Then he calls for his chiefs of his captains, of his armies, to come over, and you put your foot neck of those kings. That was a normal thing to do when you captured kings back in those days. It was to show your superiority over them. Okay? And so he had his captains to do that. He also put them on trees, it says, hang them on trees. A lot of times this is the way they hung them on trees. They impaled them with a tree and stuck them up. This is of course a relief that was found. That's not necessarily these particular ones, but this is the type of action that a lot of the armies did. And they would put the kings, they would stick these poles up through them and put them up on them. Leave them hanging up there for a period of time. I think things are gruesome today. It was kind of gruesome back then as well, you know. But that was to show that they were overpowered. And of course, they were dead when that basically happened anyway. Yes, sir. That's right. Yes. Very good point. Very good point. These kings were deserving of this because of their throwing their children to Moloch and so forth. Yeah, you're exactly right. This is exactly what God wanted to happen with all these nations. Israel now has advantage, might say, and so they go through the cities of the south. They conquer each one of them as they came to them, and the cities of Makeda, Libna, Lachish, Eglon, Hebron, Debir, all destroyed. All of these were destroyed. And there's Makeda, Libna, where it's located, Lachish. Lachish was actually built on a tell. We have got some other stuff at home that I couldn't put on this, but shows the tell of Lachish and how many times it had been destroyed and rebuilt, and it's actually on a hill type now, or at least it was some point in time. Eglon, and a lot of these cities the same way. Hebron, I think there's a tale of Hebron as well. Debir. So anyway, the cave that these kings had actually sought their refuge in actually became their grave, because they put them back in there and throw them back in, and they covered the mouth and sealed it up with stones. This is what Jehovah will do to all of your enemies, is what Joshua tells all the Israelite army. From Kadesh Barnea to Gibeon, every enemy was defeated. Where was Kadesh Barnea? Remember? Way down south, wasn't it? That's right. Okay. Way down south in the land of Canaan. And Gibeon is more or less almost halfway up, just right close to, straight over from Jerusalem, more or less. Joshua was able to destroy all these kings and their cities because Jehovah was with them. Joshua and Israel then returned to Gilgal. And Jimmy brought out the fact that it was the only Gilgal was down close to Jordan. Bob seems to think that there was another one on the upper plains up there. And we won't really debate that. I mean, it's read the scripture and determine for yourself on that. So we have several of those cities were destroyed, and these are some of them that was actually mentioned, Joshua 11. This begins the northern campaign now. After the southern campaign was finished, the central campaign, then the southern campaign, and now we're going for the northern section. And that's where they'll be fighting. And this fighting didn't happen in a short period of time. This happened over several, a good long period of time. I don't know exactly how many years, but it took a while for all this to happen. All right, so Jabin, king of Hazor. Anybody remember where Hazor is? I got a mental picture of where Hazor is. Think. Right? Okay, just down below the Sea of Galilee, isn't it? Isn't that right, Hazor? We'll see it in just a minute on the map. Okay. But anyway, the King Hazor heard about Israel's conquest of the southern hill country and all the things to the south. So he knew something had to be done to stop Israel from coming and taking their land also. So he sent to the following kings, Madon, Shimron, Akseth, kings of the north and the hill country, and the Jordan Valley near Shinaroth, and also those in the plains and at Dor. He was intending on having a big army. So he called the Canaanites, the Hivites, the Amorites, the Hittites, the Perizzites, and the Jebusites. All of these people. And so there was an army that assembled like the sands of the sea, told in the scripture, Joshua 11. They had many horses and chariots, and they made camp at the waters of Merom. This was the largest army that Joshua will encounter. His taking the promised land. Give you an idea of where all these people were located. This is Hazor, just south of the Sea of Galilee, just across the Jordan. And Madian, talked about. Shimron, Akshaph, Dor. These are the places called the Canaanites, Hivites, Amorites, Hittites, Perizzites, and the Jebusites. All came. They all were called to come. And you see how much of a territory this actually covered from... you think about all the armies from all these places coming now against Israel at one time. And you can see that this would be probably the greatest amount of men coming, army, armed men coming against Israel at any one time. Joshua 11, do not be afraid of this mighty army, God told Joshua. You can just imagine that that could be a possibility. Tomorrow at this time I'll deliver them to be slain before Israel. That's hard to imagine, that, you know, that big of an army, and yet we know that God could do this. We've learned several times throughout the Scripture how entire armies, 185,000, were killed in, you know, one night. You know, and I don't know how many was with this one. But anyway, God told Joshua, you capture them, you cripple their horses. I mean, to cripple a horse. All right, can't be used in battle, okay? Still allows it to be used to walk on or ride on maybe, but not fast. And it can be used in plowing. I'm not even sure about that, if they'd have enough strength to do that or not. But anyway, they were to cripple them so that they could not be used in war. And their chariots were to be burned. Why did Israel not want to use horses and chariots? I mean, you'd think, man, they could really have a big army then. Very good. God didn't want them to use it. And why? They would depend on God. Very good, Charles. That's exactly right. They would depend on Him. And God didn't want them to. And so they did not. Joshua and his forces came upon the enemy very suddenly. At the waters of Merom, the Lord gave them into their hands. They destroyed them and ran them to Sidon and Israel, Maim, Valley of Mizpah, and even further than that. They ran that far. Israel fought until there were no enemies left. Horses were crippled. The chariots were burned. Okay? Right. Yeah, they could not have the speed and the ability to pull chariots or those kind of things, I assume, the way they crippled them. But you're right, that's exactly right. they were not to have horses to rely on, basically. Israel came to Hazor and took it and burned it with fire because it was the main source of this whole alliance. Burned Hazor. Remember where it was? Where was it? Well, I showed it a while ago. Just below the Sea of Galilee, just across the Jordan. Okay? Very good. All right. Israel made a circuit, captured all the cities, destroying the kings with their armies. After this, there were some of the kings still around. Israel took many spoils of war. They put to death every man as they were commanded of God. Hazor dates back to about 1,500 years before this. So it goes way back a long ways. Close to, what, before Abraham's day? That would be even before Abraham, I guess. But anyway, it had massive walls. It had about a 200-acre encompass. So that was a huge city, if you think about it. Compared to Jericho, which had about 7 acres. I was telling you last week that the Bible school area right up here, that little block that the Bible school sits on, is 9 acres. That tells you about how big Jericho was. But you think about 200 acres, that would encompass a large area. Hazor was rebuilt after the days of Joshua. We will encounter later on Canaanite kings in Hazor in the days of Deborah the judge. We'll run into that. How some of them actually came back, and you might say, how did this happen? And we'll get into that too. Solomon also makes it one of his fortified cities to control the northern part of his empire or kingdom when Solomon begins to reign as king of Israel. The cities, a lot of them were not burned. Why were they not burned? A lot of the cities. Okay. And the other ones were left, and that way the houses were already prepared in those cities. Israel just had to move in, you know, to those cities that they wanted to. They wouldn't have to even fool building a house. It also left a place for any who escaped go to and to restart their the different Jebusites or those types of people, and we'll run into these as time goes by because they didn't remove every single person. They go back and start kind of rebuilding their groups again, and Israel has to deal with them because they did not completely wipe them out. Why did they not completely wipe them out? Rick? Yeah? Was there a reason that they didn't completely wipe them out? God tell them not to? What would happen if all of them were completely destroyed? Animals would come in and take over those areas. So that's the reason that some of them basically were left. And as the Israelites came in and started setting up places on their different lands, then they were to go in and remove those people. That was their job, to come in and finish destroying those Canaanites, Jebusites, whoever, in those particular areas. And then when they would move in, then they would all be gone. But the problem was, they did not remove them when they got there. And so not time to move into the Canaanites. So the Canaanites came back, and they show up later, as we'll look at. Summary of the victories. And this is Kadesh Barnea down here. And you might say, this is what they conquered. All of these, basically all these cities, all the way up Hazor. Unreal that that many places could be destroyed or done away with, burned. Joshua 12, verse 1 through 24, tells of the kings that were conquered. Verses 1 through 6 tells of the kings on the east side of Jordan that were conquered, east side of the river. When were those done? Those conquered. On the way. Some of them were on the way. Of course, some of them during this campaign and the northern campaign as well, I'll assume that some of them were over there. The remainder of the chapter gives the kings on the west side of the river. That's what is in chapter 12 that lists all of these kings and their territories. There were still some Canaanites left throughout the land. The conquest has gone as God had intended it, even though some of them were left. God has led them to victory over every king, city that challenged them. That's what God said He'd do. Oh, Joshua, don't be afraid. Wherever you set your foot, you will conquer those land. Comment? Okay. Okay. That was Exodus
23.
Okay. Very good. Exodus 23, 28 and following gives the time frame more or less for how long it took them to clear the land. Very good. Thank you, Jimmy. Israelites are now in control of the land. And the final task is for them to finish clearing out the inhabitants little by little. As you mentioned, Deuteronomy, the 7th chapter, tells that, verse 20 through 24 as well. God said that He would not drive out all the Canaanites because of the animals would come in and fill the land where there was no people around, basically. And it would all grow up and wild beasts take over. God assured them that He would continue to help them to drive out all that were left. Let's look at Joshua, the 13th chapter, on this line. In verse 6, all the inhabitants of the hill country from Lebanon to Misrath Maim, and all the Sidonians, them will I drive out from before the children of Israel. Only divide it thou it by lot unto the Israelites for an inheritance, as I have commanded thee. Now therefore divide this land for an inheritance into the 9.5 tribes, half tribe of Manasseh, of course, with whom the Reubenites, Gadites had received their inheritance. Moses gave them beyond Jordan, even as Moses, the servant of the Lord, gave them. So we know that all the other ones had their lot on the west side of Jordan, and got out of time. But I ran through that pretty hurriedly. Have you got some comments you'd like to make about this? Carl, gotta be not afraid when we try to teach others. That's right, teach other people. You're going to run into people who may slam the door in your face. And yet you may also see some doors open that like's being done down in Brazil area. Those doors are just opening up right and left for the gospel to spread down there. It's just amazing. I just got a word from Dennis Allen about how it is. Just doors are just opening and people being baptized. They baptized a Baptist preacher down there. It's a lot of good things going on down that way. Anyway, all right. Thank you all for your participation tonight.